In the foggy mornings of Oregon in the early 1960s, a 24-year-old Phil Knight found himself at life's crossroads. Despite his Stanford MBA and Army service, something was missing. During a morning run, clarity struck. He wanted to experience what athletes feel without being one himself. This epiphany birthed his crazy idea, importing Japanese running shoes to America. What began with selling shoes from the trunk of his Plymouth Valiant would eventually transform into Nike, one of the world's most recognizable brands. Knight's journey captures the essence of entrepreneurial spirit against seemingly impossible odds. What makes his story so compelling isn't just the astronomical success, but the deeply human elements woven throughout: doubt, persistence, betrayal, and triumph. Have you ever wondered what separates those who merely dream from those who build empires? Knight's answer is disarmingly simple: belief. When you have a dream, you've got to grab it and never let go, he often reflected. His unwavering conviction in the superior quality of his product made his sales pitch naturally compelling, allowing him to sell through his first inventory of 300 pairs and confidently order 900 more. Nike's early team was composed of outsiders and dreamers, united by their passion for running. Jeff Johnson, Knight's first employee, exemplified this spirit. A former social worker who took a pay cut to sell Tiger shoes, believing runners were God's chosen. His revolutionary customer service included detailed record keeping and personal touches like birthday cards and handwritten notes about customers' running progress. Bob Woodell, whose track career ended after becoming wheelchair-bound, transformed his competitive drive into developing Nike's foundational inventory systems. He maintained unwavering focus even when working in their dilapidated first office, where pigeons routinely left droppings through ceiling holes onto his desk. Knight's hands-off leadership philosophy: don't tell people how to do things, tell them what to do, and let them surprise you with their results, created an environment where innovation flourished. Their biannual butt-face management retreats, named because the entire team would turn when someone yelled, "Hey, butt-face," embodied a culture where authenticity and passionate disagreement were valued over politeness. By 1971, despite doubling sales annually, Knight discovered Onitsuka, their Japanese supplier, was secretly planning to end their partnership. He learned this after glimpsing documents in Kitami's briefcase, revealing meetings with competing American distributors. Kitami then demanded 51% controlling interest in Blue Ribbon Sports. Simultaneously, First National Bank terminated their credit line despite years of business. The crisis sparked transformation. Knight hired Carolyn Davidson, a Portland State art student, to design a logo for $35. She created the swoosh, which Knight initially viewed with skepticism. "Maybe it will grow on me." The company name, Nike, after the Greek goddess of victory, was chosen with similar hesitation. When Knight informed Blue Ribbon's 30 employees about Onitsuka's departure, he reframed the crisis. "What I'm trying to say is, we've got them right where we want them." This wasn't mere optimism. The betrayal had freed them to build their own brand. Though their first Nike shoes had imperfections, including crooked swooshes, salesmen placed orders based on Blue Ribbon's trusted reputation. Innovation became Nike's lifeblood, with Bill Bowerman as its mad scientist mentor. His obsession with lighter shoes stemmed from his mantra: 1 ounce sliced off a pair of shoes is equivalent to 55 pounds over 1 mile. He constantly experimented, disassembling shoes and testing new materials on University of Oregon runners. The breakthrough came at breakfast when Bowerman, inspired by his wife's waffle iron, envisioned a new outsole design. Despite ruining the appliance with urethane, his experiment birthed the revolutionary waffle trainer. Its patterned sole provided superior traction and cushioning through raised nubs. When a test runner broke his personal record in the prototype, Bowerman called Knight ecstatic about his divinely inspired creation. This everyday inspiration, a simple waffle iron, transformed athletic footwear. The shoe's blue colorway, designed to match jeans, helped bridge the gap between athletic and casual wear, pioneering what would later be called athleisure. Nike faced several existential crises in its early years. In 1975, Nike was $75,000 short on a $1 million payment to Nisho, their Japanese financial partner. A failed attempt at circular funding led to bounced paychecks, frozen accounts, and FBI scrutiny. Rather than concealing their troubles, Nike chose complete transparency with Nisho. During the subsequent audit, they discovered Nike's secret factory, but surprisingly, Nisho executive Ito smiled. Even more shocking, Sumeragi admitted he'd been hiding invoices to help Nike's cash flow. In 1977, U.S. Customs demanded $25 million in back duties, nearly matching Nike's annual revenue. This crisis, sparked by competitors lobbying for enforcement of an old law, hit Nike particularly hard. His solution was ingenious, launching One Line, an American-made budget shoe that forced Customs to use lower price points for duty calculations. Combined with a patriotic marketing campaign portraying Nike as a small Oregon company fighting government overreach, the strategy succeeded. The government ultimately settled for $9 million. Knight's devotion to Nike strained his family relationships, particularly with his sons. When he'd return from management retreats, his children would question his absences, with Matthew even refusing to wear Nikes. The irony was stark. While Knight's life centered on sports, including his relationship with his own father, his sons wanted nothing to do with them. The pressure took a physical toll as well. During the customs crisis, Knight's nervous habits intensified, and he experienced concerning rage episodes. Years of stress exhausted him, with only his nightly runs providing relief. Yet amidst these sacrifices came moments of validation. During a Lakers-Rockets game, Knight received a call from his father, thrilled at seeing the swoosh on Tom Janovich's shoes. Though his father never said proud, the excitement in his voice conveyed what words didn't. From his Palm Springs vantage point, Knight reflected on Nike's growth to a $16 billion global enterprise. The Beaverton campus honored this legacy, with buildings named for athletes and streets commemorating founding fathers, including a Japanese garden marking their Nisho partnership. His athlete relationships transcended business, from celebrating with Sampras at Wimbledon to Jordan's deeply personal gesture at his father's funeral. Through profound losses, his son Matthew, his parents, Bowerman's passing on Christmas Eve 1999, and Strasser's sudden death, Knight learned business was inherently personal. This conviction shaped their response to the sweatshop controversy, spurring innovations that eliminated 97% of factory carcinogens, technology they shared with competitors. His 1962 crazy idea became a global symbol of athletic excellence and human potential. Knight's journey shows that true entrepreneurship means following a calling, embracing challenges, recognizing luck's role, and maintaining faith, all embodied in Nike's essence. Just do it.